Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined today by a slew of Inside Lacrosse's finest as we are discussing the countdown of the top 50 men's college lacrosse players for 2024. Right now, joined by Editor-in-Chief Matt Kinnear, alongside Dan Kaplan and Kevin Brown, and later on, we'll be joined by Patrick McEwen. Fellas, Thanksgiving's in the rear view. Spring is marching toward us. How's everybody holding up? Matt, you look good.
Doing great. Schedules, you know, we are currently talking about schedules for the 2024 lacrosse season. We have a bunch of them uploaded into our calendar. So it's a great time of the year because we are that much closer to a new lacrosse season, and we're talking about the top 50 players. So it's awesome.
So we're going to start by discussing how we did this. And it was pretty simple, actually. The five of us each ranked 50 players from 1 to 50, and then we ran a bunch of numbers in terms of tallying the votes, figuring out mean, median, standard deviation, all that sort of stuff. If only Patrick were here to discuss it, we'd probably get a much drier, longer explanation for what it actually meant. But interestingly, it more than anything else showed how much consensus and how little disagreement there was among the top five. Kevin, this podcast is it's being recorded on Tuesday. It's going to come out on Wednesday. So we're going to spoil the top five, which won't be unveiled until Friday. Can you do the honors?
Drum roll, please. Coming in at number...
The fact that he's actually doing the drum roll with his hands means that he didn't use that to buy time in order to navigate to the window on his computer that actually had the top 50 in it.
So I also totally regret doing that because it immediately woke up a sleeping dog that was on the couch being totally cool. And now she like thinks someone's at the door.
So any dog noises during this recording, you gotta fire off hot takes immediately. So
I like that.
I still don't have the window open, but I do have the top five memorized, as there is maybe a surprise at number five in terms of who you think is the most valuable player on the reigning champions in terms of attackman Pat Cavanaugh coming in at number five. Then we have goalie Liam Entman coming in right above him at number four. Some contention with two and three here, as three is attackman CJ Kirst out of Cornell, and Virginia attackman Connor Schellenberger takes the number two spot, as reigning Tourton winner Brennan O'Neill is IL's top player for 2024.
All five of us had those five guys in their top five. There was no interloper. The order was different. Dan, what was your order?
So I had Brennan at first, right? I think everybody did. Not sure that there was any deviation there. Second, I went with Schellenberger. Third was Entman, fourth was Kirst, and then fifth was, who am I blanking here?
Cavanaugh.
Fifth was Cavanaugh. So,
Kirst the lowest.
Correct. And I think I also, you'll see a couple themes here, which I guess one goes against it because Cavanaugh came in at fifth, but goalies and party starters are two guys that I kind of valued, I think, a little bit differently compared to the rest of you guys.
Matt, you and I were highest on CJ Kirst. We both had him as number two. How do you justify that decision?
Well, for one, I think you could have argued him as the Tourton winner last year. If you just kind of go back to their 2023 resume. But I also put, I think, a more significant stock in the summer box experience and summer international experience for those guys as well. And, you know, I think what you saw Kirst do up in Canada this summer was definitely worthwhile and, you know, showed a level of improvement that I thought from an already spectacular season. Plus, I just think he's a more, not to say that Cornell's offense isn't deep and talented all around, but I think he is a more crucial central part to that offense, whereas Virginia's has so many different pieces that you could argue, you know, kind of who was the more integral focus of that offense.
Oh, no way. Schellenberger is the party starter. He's the guy that stirs the drink for
he certainly for the Cavs. Is, but I also think that there's other guys who could do that and be successful on that team.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we just had a conversation about how Jack Boyden is going to fill the Slim Reaper role either earlier this week or last week. And in part and parcel of that conversation was his ability to dodge off the catch and, you know, how many assists he had that contributed, you know, that added to his what he had 60 goals, right? But then you look at it from the other end of the spectrum, and Griffin Schutz, a former number one overall recruit, is just as capable of running the offense. So I'm not going to disagree that there is a gap between what Schellenberger and Kirst could do, but I would heartily disagree that there is a gap between what they did do. And I would also say that when you look at, you know, some of the limitations, and I think when you look at it over the last 2 years, a lot of it has been attributable to soft tissue injuries. I would give the durability and availability nod to Kirst over Schellenberger as well.
I give him the athletic nod as well. He can get his own shot, I think, against more matchups than Schellenberger. I just think Schellenberger is a more complete player as a pass-first attackman, coming in as one of the most lethal shooters from the high school ranks in recent memory. And then, I don't know, I'm not ready to – because we had him as the number one ranked player last year on this countdown list, mind you. And maybe CJ Kirst is getting closer, but I'm still sticking to the Shells at number two.
Yeah, your point about injuries, I kind of give him the benefit of the doubt. I feel similar. I think I have McEnany higher than some people voted as well. So in both of those instances, I think I get your point about that. But looking into this season, assuming that they stay healthy, perhaps is a poor assumption based on you know, what's happened in the past couple of seasons. But with that assumption in mind, I had him higher.
Dan, you said that you think you value goalies and party starters a little differently than other folks on the list. What do you mean, and how did that affect the way you valued Liam Entenmann?
Yeah, so goalies and party starters, I think two things come to mind. The first of which is, like, anytime you talk to a coach or, you know, anybody, any coach that any offense that I've coached or anything like that, so many of the issues boil down to we can't win matchups, right? Like, how many times have you talked to a Division I coach that says, like, oh, we have no problem orchestrating hands-free shots, we just can't get them to go into the back of the goal? Or, you know, like, so many of the issues I think stem down to, you know, can we draw slides? When can we start slides? And can we do it quickly, especially with, you know, shot clock era taking over? And perhaps that's an outdated take too. But the idea that you're going to need to start offense quickly and that one single individual can give you that that fix, but then also make a really good decision when they are slid to, I think is really important. And then for goalies, there's a guy that I think doesn't make the list here. I'm doing a lot of talking early, but a guy that doesn't make our list here, Bobby Van Buren. And I think part of that is Ohio State's defensive efficiency. And I think part of that efficiency number has been goalie play. So you look at a guy like McEnany and Entenmann, who I have, you know, kind of higher than the rest. And I guess not too much higher if everybody had Entenmann in the top five, but you know, just some examples of why I think those guys are so important.
It's also the hardest position, right? And it's McEnany, by the way, not McEnany, but let you get away with it for the first time, but I had to chime in. I do agree, because I do come from the Kaplan school of thought on a lot of this, with the party starters are super valuable. And I think you see it from the rest of our list of, as we go down this top 50, the philosophy of, like, offensive players, attackmen specifically, are by nature, I think, the most talented lacrosse players. If you're not good enough to play the attack, you're finding a role elsewhere on the field. And goalie, with a lot of these guys taking so many shots per game, it's, I mean, definitely the hardest position in my opinion to save the ball. So as we go down to some of these topics we're about to hit, I think you see a lot of that.
Matt, do you mind just kind of summarizing this conversation around the top five by addressing Kevin's point that maybe it'll be surprising to some that the guy who was the most important player, potentially, the Tewerton finalist from the defending national champions, slotted in at number five in Pat Cavanaugh?
Why he's at number five?
Yeah.
Explain that.
Is that too low?
Well, I mean, injury concerns, obviously. You know, I think that's definitely got to play a huge part of it. You know, this list is not just, it's not an end of season All-America list like the ones that we produce in May every year. You know, this takes into account what we've seen from fall ball, what we've seen from the summer, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, best ability is availability. And Pat Cavanaugh, you know, was not out there with the Irish this fall in their scrimmages. So I think you do have to give him a little bit of a knock there. But, you know, he's a Cavanaugh. He's tough as nails. You expect him to be back. So that's why you put him at five, not at 15. Kevin, what? You're smiling.
The best ability is not availability. The best ability is ability. I just hate this argument because people used it a lot during Joel Embiid's early years in the NBA, and it was just drives me crazy when I hear the phrase. So I've got to be like,
well, it's true. It's a reason that, you know, Mario Lemieux is not as great as Wayne Gretzky is because Mario Lemieux, you know, had all of his career health issues and Wayne Gretzky did not. Again, we're splitting hairs and it's the top five. You know, when you are the top five player in the country, the standard is incredibly high, and that includes, you know, your ability to play a full season. So, you know, I hope the best. And I have on the flip side,
and
of
to
that,
be clear, you know, Pat Cavanaugh hasn't been unavailable historically over the course of his career, in you know, probably not even to the extent that Connor Schellenberger has, but he played on a torn hamstring in the national championship game and his production was limited as a result. And then on the Pat McAfee show, he disclosed that he returned to South Bend after the summer carrying an injury and was operated upon then. So I do think it's reasonable, especially when it comes to the fine margins that you're talking about, to say, I got to pick something. There's nothing about his game that I don't like or love. So what other basis do I have to make this decision?
Right, exactly. And it's, again, I expect in May, we're going to see Pat Cavanaugh out there and he's going to be tearing it up. But hey, maybe it's going to take him a few weeks, maybe, you know, a month or two to really get to his full speed based on what we know about his health.
Let's expand the conversation beyond the top five. And I think the most interesting way to do so is to talk about a few of the guys among whom there was the widest disagreement or largest gap in their rankings. And Dan, you already touched on one, and Kevin, you corrected the pronunciation of Logan McNaney, the goalie for Maryland, who was injured in the Terps game against Loyola last year and missed the remainder of the season. Didn't get a ton of run in the fall in terms of their public scrimmages, but reports out of College Park he should be good to go in the spring. Dan, you had him highest. Kevin and Patrick did not have Logan in their top 50. Why don't we start there? What makes you so confident in McNaney's contribution this spring?
My, oh my, how quickly we forget. You guys see this up here? One for the ages.
For those of you that are listening to this, because it's in an audio format, he's pointing to the championship issue cover of the Inside Lacrosse June 2022 edition. So, yes, people have forgotten, Dan.
People have forgotten. And he was also the 22 NCAA tournament most outstanding player. And I don't have like a whole bunch of numbers and statistics to throw at you, but I got those accolades. I got that title right over my shoulder. I got my instincts that tell me that he is a winner. I also have my PLL hat on, and we talked a little bit about like how we went about making our lists. I think one mindset that I kind of went into was if I was a PLL GM, like, and I was creating a board, best player available, who's the next one, so on and so forth. Like, he's a winner. He's on my board. And for that reason, he's in the top 50 as well.
Wait, so Kevin, you just didn't have him?
Yeah, it's...
And wait, and you slandered my Pat Cavanaugh moving him to five instead of four?
Turp on turp crime.
You call yourself a turp?
In Kevin's defense, and you might be about to make this argument, so I apologize if I'm stealing the point, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Logan McNaney beats out Brian Ruppel to start the season.
So I did ask in the Slack, and Terry was the one that pretty quickly shut it down. What are the chances McNaney splits halves with Brian Ruppel after a pretty good debut season for the freshman? And I wouldn't put it at 0% like Terry did, but listen, McNaney is an awesome goalie. I'm not going to die on the hill that he's not a top 50 player, especially so he's ranked number 20 in this countdown last season. And I don't think a season-ending injury should plop you out of the top 50, but there's just so many good goalies. I left out Chase Erlin and Will Mark as well, and those were very tough decisions.
Unbelievable. So,
while there's a lot of regret with this exercise, there's also...
You can't get 23 attackmen in the top 50 if you don't leave out all the good goalies, Dan.
Exactly. So that's just the attackmen in me thinking that attackmen are just the best.
I get the point with Ruppel playing well last year and, you know, the prospect that maybe there is some sort of split time situation. But I don't know. You just can't bet against the best goalie at Maryland being, you know, an All-American at the end of the year or like some sort of deep NCAA tournament run. That's just history has proven that Maryland goalies are elite and they go deep into May. So I can't bet against them.
I also think we can bet on Coach Tillman giving the nod to the vet. Maybe I'm wrong there, but that's my assumption.
I think he's
that would be my assumption too. They do seem to have a special relationship and you know, I saw them in the fall and you know, he was in street clothes and he was warming up the goalies. Logan was. So, you know, again, I didn't see any visual evidence of him out there and how he looks and stuff like that. But I would say that it's going to be my guess if I'm, you know, and this is totally just my guess, not any inside knowledge of the program, is maybe you'll see some split time situation early. And then Logan kind of takes control and is the starter in, you know, serious gameplay situations for the rest of the year.
Moving along. Peyton Cormier next up in terms of the widest spread. Patrick McEwen was the highest on him, and I actually didn't have him in my top 50. Cormier notched in at number 28, one spot ahead of McNaney's 29. And if I had to justify it, I think that I kind of already have earlier in this conversation when I talked about the role that Schellenberger, Schutz, and now Boyden are going to play. You know, there are a couple factors here. One of them is just when I watched Virginia's offense and compared the differences between how good they were when he was on the field and how good they were when he was off the field, I came to a pretty specific conclusion, which is that I think their ceiling was lower and their floor was higher when he was not on the field. So essentially, Cormier has the ability to raise Virginia's offensive ceiling, but at the same time, his potential tendency to overcarry and take the ball out of other guys' sticks relative to where that falls as his primary, you know, attribute or role compared to the other three or four guys who are probably better suited to do that can lead to a little bit of stodginess or a little bit of stickiness. I am particularly concerned about that issue kind of growing in an offense that doesn't have as familiar of a two-man game lefty-lefty partner without Thomas McConvey. And when a new offensive coordinator in Kevin Cassis comes in and doesn't have the same amount of credibility to tell Cormier to move the ball that Sean Kerwin did. And is it justifiable to say that he's not a top 50 player as a result? Potentially not, and he is. And that's why we do this on consensus, not on the basis of any individual's opinion. But for me, I only had 12 attackmen in my top 50. And based on what I just said, it's pretty easy for me to argue that I don't think Peyton Cormier is a top 12 attackman in the country.
All right, here's why you're wrong. So Peyton Cormier, pretty under the radar. So I was in charge of writing the next batch, which listeners will see on Wednesday here, of players. And he comes in at number 28, like you mentioned, Terry. So he's 7 goals away from the all-time Virginia goal-scoring record. And he, if he has another 50-goal season, which he's done pretty much every year down in Charlottesville that he's been there, he'll finish only behind the last two all-time record holders in Justin Gutterding and Mac O'Keefe, all-time for Division I. So I do get your point of his role in the offense, but his ability to finish the ball, anyone who jams it inside, he'll finish everything off, and he just uses his body in such a way that he overpowers his matchups. And it's, I think he's clearly a top 50 player.
Let's talk about somebody who I was highest on then. That is Notre Dame short stick D Mitty, Ben Ramsey. Ramsey checked in at number 34. Believe it or not, I had him number 7. I had him as the 7th best player in college lacrosse.
What?
Kevin, you didn't have him in your top 50. By the end of the season, Ben Ramsey was, in my opinion, very clearly the number one short stick D Mitty on the best team in the country. And I build more improvement into his arc because of how young he is than most of the other folks that are in that neighborhood. Does it mean he can play offense? I mean, I don't know. We'll see. But when you consider what Quinn McCann and Brian Tevlin did for the Fighting Irish last year and how instrumental they were to that team's success, I just, is it an overreaction? Maybe. But if I'm going to justify it, it's going to be by saying something along the lines of, when I saw him play against Georgetown, I went into that game with like holding Nick Harris in tremendously high regard. And I still do. It's not really a comment about Nick Harris, but by the end of the season, the distance that he had separated from the rest of the position group with and how impressive he was, it was jaw dropping to me. You know, this is a kid I saw play in high school at Gonzaga, and I don't really even remember him from the game. So his rate of improvement is exceptional. And to your point, Kevin, about the best lacrosse players being attackmen, the best athletes on a lacrosse field are the short stick D middies, and they're asked to do more than anybody else because they are constantly getting dodged, and then they have to clear the ball, and sometimes they have to play the wings of faceoffs, and then they have to take advantage of their opportunities in transition, and then they have to sprint off the field in order to give the offense, as you cake eaters, as much opportunity to use the shot clock as possible. And then the next time out, they've got to go out and get dodged 2 or 3 times on a defensive sequence. So I don't know offhand how many short sticks I had in my top 50, probably 6 or 7. But yeah, he was in my opinion the best.
And I think even by your own admission, it was a pretty aggressive ranking at 7. But if it was the top 50 or even the top 20 role players, he'd be definitely up there for me. But top 50 players, and I think some of this thinking just comes from the graduated class of D middies all across the country. I think there's just a little bit too much of a drop off to include too many defensive midfielders in my top 50 this year. Losing Piper Bond, losing Peyton Rizonka, and Connor Marr, to name a few. Just, I think Ramsey's going to be awesome, but he's one of those players within the 50-60 range for me.
I have ammo for Terry.
Lay it on me.
Ammo that Kevin is not going to like. Kevin, where did you vote Mr. Russell Melendez?
I had Mr. Melendez looking.
38.
32, 38. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good ranking. You have some homework after this. You got to go back. You're going to watch the Notre Dame Johns Hopkins game, and you're going to watch Hop set up picks for the Dodger with Mr. Melendez. And then you're going to watch Notre Dame just switch them. And then you're going to watch Ben Ramsey just let Mr. Melendez catch the ball and then guard him and not get slid to. So that'll be the ammo that you need to up your arsenal for Mr. Ben Ramsey there.
Woo! Coming in hot.
There's no denying.
He also had 7 goals on 10 shots last year. 13 caused turnovers, 22 ground balls. in 16 games. Not a big ground ball total. That's a pretty substantial.
His NCAA tournament was awesome. Yeah. I just think
we spent too much time talking about a short stick D mini. Let's keep it moving.
We didn't spend enough time talking about short stick D minis. I have one higher than him, actually.
Who's that?
Bo Pettersson. Mr. Princeton to Michigan. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think that's who most of us rated as the top D midi.
There's one spot in the top 50 where there is incredibly strong variety. And I think it's just kind of interesting to isolate the group. And then we'll start talking about individual selections. And Matt, we know we got to get you out of here. Numbers 23 to 18 had some of the widest distribution. So Jack Frassian, Jake Naso, Scott Smith, TJ Malone, and Joey Spallina. So, you know, just kind of talking about the group in general, Matt, any thoughts on why those guys were so polarizing? It makes sense that they would kind of isolate to that mid-high range of the overall list, but anything jump out there for you when you look at that group of players?
Well, I mean, it is kind of like, you know, just like a normal distribution in terms of like, you know, there's the elite and then you get to the chunk in the middle and it's kind of just vast and you don't know what to do with it. But like, a few things is I think all of us, and I don't know if struggled is the right word, but we had to decide what our role in terms of defenders. There was a higher variance in terms of like who we valued and what skill we valued in terms of, you know, is it a guy who is a lockdown cover guy? Or I know Patrick's going to come on, and when he's talking about Gepard, is going to have some strong thoughts on this about why he thinks he's such a good defenseman. So I think we all struggled in terms of who was our number, you know, after Ajax Zapatello and maybe Cole Kastner as, you know, kind of some of the guys who were, I think, maybe most of our top two defensively, not you, Terry. But I think we kind of struggled with that glut of defenders, that Bobby Van Buren, that Scott Smith, you know, that whole group there. And then Spallina was surprisingly polarizing in the sense that I had him much higher, I believe, than most people did. And, you know, well, I had him on the higher end of what most people did. And again, I think that's just valuing that guy who is the, like, you want this guy with the ball in his stick when there's 30 seconds left and it's, you know, a tie game and you need someone to score. That's who I'm going to value in these lists. But specifically with the defenseman, I think we all struggled in terms of like who is the cover guy versus who is the glue guy, you know, who is kind of the facilitator and where do we value those in our order in ranking.
Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely overvalue like athleticism when it comes to defenders, when it comes to the communicators and sort of the organizers of defenses. In my mind, I feel like if you're not athletic enough, you can just become that. But I think it's, as we're starting to allude to, Patrick being one of the smarter among us can point out why the smartest defenders are so valuable. And I do think there were some discrepancies with our voting with the specialists in terms of the goalies and faceoff specialists. I know Jake Naso pretty low on my list. I think he's one of the face-off, if not the most well-rounded all-around lacrosse player of the elite face-off men in this ranking list. And him or Weirman for me. And Spallina, I'm really interested in your take, Terry, because you had him the lowest and in terms of kind of a him versus TJ Malone comparison or just him alone, just what are your thoughts of Spallina and his role in the Syracuse offense?
Yeah, it's going to be I'm glad that you ended that question the way that you did, because my explanation is going to fold back on itself in a dumb way. Essentially, my contention is that the overall increase in talent at Syracuse will result in this weird combination where Joey might very well produce at a you know, as well or higher of a rate than he did last year. I think they're going to have the ball more. I think that the guys that he's throwing open are going to be more dangerous shooters. I think he's going to have more space as a Dodger because of the stickiness that the other five guys on defense are going to show the players they're marking. But weirdly, and I should note, you know, if we included freshmen in this, I don't know where I would have had him heading into last season, but it probably would have been like in the, if we had gone down to the, you know, 50s, 60s, that's probably, I mean, really high. I would have had him very high going into last season. And this year, you know, I think I have him 43. And that, so point being that like, it's not as much more than I would have had him last year relative to the fact that I think he's going to produce better. I just think that what he's going to be asked to do is a little bit more limited, and it's going to be more in the flow of the offense. It's going to be more conducive to his strengths. So point being, I guess that, you know, when I was ranking the attackmen who, you know, would dodge number one pulls, late shot clock, or you know, some of the other criteria that you would have used in order to make these decisions, you know, I felt like he was probably in that, you know, 10, 11 best attackman type range. I guess the other way that I would think about it is like, how seriously, okay, so looking at this a second time, I have him immediately behind in, from an attackman standpoint, Melendez and Ross Scott, and immediately in front of Reese Burek and Matt Trainer. So for me, like that's appropriate company. It's just that, you know, in between Ross Scott, who I had at number 33, and Joey Spallina, you know, I have 11 or 12 specialists. I have Will Mark, Evan Plunkett, Jack Posey, Richard Checo, Sammy English, Will Coletti, Shane Knobloch, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's where I come down on that and poke holes, but that's the explanation.
I would only push back. I think it's a good explanation. Well, the first half of it, I was like, this is sound all good reasons to rank him higher, but the way you brought it around, I think I would only push back.
If he had like 65 points last year, I could very easily imagine him having 90 as a sophomore. But in terms of like who's going to have three game winning goals, I think Jake Stevens, Sammy English, Christian Mulet, like I think those guys are just as likely to, whereas I think pretty clearly Joey would have been the end of game guy in one goal games last season.
Which I think answers what I was about to bring up, and I don't want to slander Russell Melendez at all, but I had Spallina in front of Melendez in terms of role and production. You look at Hopkins' offense, Jacob Angeles was mostly the quarterback, but you did have that factor where if you needed a late clutch goal, you would go to Russ and let him cook behind the net. And we had that iconic rivalry goal with the diving backhander, of course. But the Spallina production and him kind of controlling the offense, I think, makes him suited for a higher ranking.
I want to hear Dan's thought on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that his ability to get to 5-5 and force teams to slide is unlike...
His being who?
Joey Spallina. Is unlike most players in the game anywhere. You know, like his ability to put a shoulder in and embrace physicality at GLE and use that to really drive to a spot where he doesn't even necessarily have to completely beat you to be able to score. So now defenses feel that pressure. And like you said, like there's a lot more threats around him, or the threats that were around last year are just another year older, another year more ready. Like I see his production jumping, but I see him as a guy that I think of all of the points you made, I would push back on his ability to pick the ball up and be one of the top attackmen in Division I lacrosse at creating slides.
The Melendez-Hopkins conversation is kind of an interesting one, because I actually think that from a role standpoint, Joey Spallina is way more comparable to Jacob Angeles. And if it's that comparison, I think Spallina is a better player. So obviously the ranking that I actually put out has Melendez, which is more about like the role or the absence of a player like that. I think Melendez in last year's Syracuse team was much more comparable to Cole Kearse. And then Cole Kearse goes on to have a really good PLL season. And you wonder, like, if his role were bigger or more defined, would Syracuse have had a better season? When you look at Hopkins and Syracuse side by side as teams, like on the field, they're pretty comparable in terms of how you evaluate one loss in the quarterfinals and one miss the NCAA tournament. It's not that comparable. There's a pretty wide gap between those two considerations. So I don't know. I guess my point is that I just back into a lot of different justifications where, you know, I can say that there's only one attackman, in my opinion, between Melendez and Spelina, and it's Ross Scott. So from that standpoint, I don't think we're talking about a wide gap, but I think from the standpoint of how you value attackmen relative to the other positions on the field and the point that you made earlier, Kevin, that's probably where I just have a wider purview than you do. And that's kind of a function of taste, bees in the eye of the beholder type situation. Matt, we understand that we're running up against it in terms of your availability. So there were a few guys who you were really high on that I found to be really interesting. One of these is kind of teeing you up to pick up the conversation that you previously had around Pat Kavanaugh, because you were highest on his brother, Chris. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a rate of improvement aspect as well when you saw what he did between, you know, his first seasons. And then, like, I don't know, the Kavanaughs are just like they're so emotive in how they play, and they play off confidence so well that I think just like this whole experience is going to just completely like shoot him into another stratosphere of like, you know, he already plays in a way that like confidence dictates the moves that he makes, you know, with that kind of underneath dive move that he does so well that you kind of give him this like, oh yeah, like when I play well, I can win a national championship, and that's just going to add rocket fuel to his game. So I really think that he's going to be awesome. And then some other guys that like, you know, I had, you know, higher than most, I guess, were Richard Checo at Lehigh. And I just think he's such a disruptive force. And, you know, him and Mason Woodward were two guys that I think I was pretty high on comparatively, in the sense that I think that they are, you know, guys who can do that with a long pole. I just really appreciate that in their game. And Shane Knobloch, who is a guy that we missed on this list last year. He had a down year by kind of his standards, but I give him a little bit more of that, like, lifetime achievement award factor, in that I think he's been one of the best midfielders in the sport of lacrosse, you know, throughout his career, starting with that great freshman year that he had. And, you know, I don't think you can look at this so singularly about, you know, what they did last year as much as their whole body of work. And he's definitely a part of that. But there was, you know, back to the defense, I struggled so much, and like Jackson Bonas was a guy I wanted to get in so badly, and AJ Pilot was a guy I wanted to get in so badly. So there's like all of these guys that I have on the cusp that weren't in our top 50 that like I wish I could be talking about them, because, you know, they're just so awesome. And maybe that's the justification to go to 100 next year when we do this list again.
No doubt. I mean, I think we all realized in doing this that we would have been able to go to 100 pretty easily. It would have been interesting. In order to get to 50, 70 players received votes. I think that's a pretty small number, that only 20 guys received a vote and didn't have a point total that was large enough to be included in the top 50. If we were to go to 100, I think that excess number, so to speak, would be at least 50. So it would be at least, what is that, 33% bigger than it currently is. And I wouldn't be shocked if 200 players received votes in order to get to 100. So it's an interesting, you know, kind of reflection of the exercise when you consider, you know, how much the opinion kind of widens as you move down the list. And Matt, that was kind of the point that you made when you talked about how substantial the consensus was at the top of the list. Let's keep it rolling with some of the other folks that were a little bit of outlier opinions. Kevin, we've already made the comment that you're high on offensive players. It's not just attackmen. You were higher on a handful of middies as well. But let's start by talking about the attackmen. You were highest on Mikey Boehm, Dyson Williams, and Jack Boyden. Just talk about those three guys.
Yeah, and we slacked a little bit about this with the Jack Boyden choice. I had him pretty high up in my mid-20s, actually. And the fact that the resident D3 king of Inside Lacrosse didn't even have him in his top 50, again, goes to taste a little bit with the role that I think he'll be filling in that Xander Dixon role. And part of me thinks it's a little bit of overcompensating for overlooking how good Xander Dixon was for Virginia last season. But the other part of me thinks Boyden might be better than Xander Dixon. So I think his
inclusion. Well, and a third part of you should think, I'm one of the very few people who actually got to go to practice and see what this looks like live.
Yes, correct. And him in a Virginia uniform was super cool to see live. And it was just in a practice setting where he's just dominating all these one-on-one matchups from X and throwing these crazy backhanded goals right into the top right corner, coming around the left side of the crease, catching everything on the crease and finishing. Really a lot of similarities with Xander Dickson's game. And we can get to the other couple attackmen, but I want to get Kaplan's take on it.
Yeah, I mean, he had 157 points last year. Terry said he was a 60-goal scorer. That's true. He was a 69. Very nice.
No, Xander Dickson was a 60-goal scorer. That's what I was saying.
Got it. Jack Boyden, 69 goals last year. 157 total points. So, yeah, I mean, like, from an ability to put the ball on the net standpoint, like, he is spectacular, and there's no denying that. If you think back to the year before that, he didn't have to do so much initiating. He had way lower assist numbers, and that was because he played with a guy named Mac Bradall, who had the ball in his stick a ton, and he had a whole bunch of assists. Those points, all of them, are certainly a little bit inflated because of how many opportunities their attack gets in transition. So that's at least worth noting. But my whole point of all of this is, to your point about role, like, we have Connor Schellenberger at two, and he's going to be the guy that, like, we can rely on to do a whole bunch of the creating. And I wouldn't be shocked if it ended up with Boyden having a whole bunch of goals and, you know, filling up stat sheets or having attacks, approaches that he can attack to then be able to, you know, do something off the dodge. But from everything that's gone on through this conversation with valuing party starters versus finishers or guys that are attacking approaches, he just didn't make my list. And there's a lot of guys that, you know, are really skilled, awesome shooters, great players, whatever it is, that are in similar boats that just didn't get the nod because of their role.
And I think I thought more along those lines last year when we did this ranking, and I've started to revert more towards, all right, some of these finishers are too good to leave off the list. And a lot of it does come down to the role these coaches give them. Like Dyson Williams, we saw in the World Championship, was awesome off the dodge when he was presented with a short stick matchup. And you read it in one of Terry's Yale game stories that Coach Andy Shea said the same thing about Chris Lyons. He's a guy who finished the season as the second leading goals per game guy in the nation, and he's not even in our top 50. So,
to be clear, if teams do decide, if UVA starts Jack Boyden at attack and teams decide they're going to short stick him so that they can double the pull the midfield, Jack Boyden will make a short stick pay. He will make your short stick pay. He's not going
to
do something.
Well, this is a good opportunity to. This is a good opportunity to revert back to something that we should have hit had he been on the podcast when we were talking about it. But Patrick McEwen is now with us. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Yay.
Hi, guys. Good to be here. Sorry for joining you a little late.
All good. The responsibilities of fatherhood continue to deprive the people from their takes on Peyton Cormier, who is a player that you were highest on. Among the group, we already went through, you know, kind of where those outlier opinions were. On some individual basis, we have saved your group of players for obviously your opportunity to talk about. But it fits so nicely into this conversation. For me, the fundamental question is, how do you evaluate goal scorers versus initiators, goal finishers versus like opportunity creators? And, you know, I started inside lacrosse in 2007, so. It's really always been like, what percentage of credits does Matt Donowski get from like an All-American standpoint versus Zach Greer or Ned Crotty versus Max Quinzani? You obviously value, and maybe it's more of a reflection of Cormier than it is like the topic in general, but where is your attitude on it, and how does Cormier fit into the conversation?
So I feel like I value Peyton Cormier above his role because I look at him as a versatile guy who could do way more than he does. Those kind of three different roles that Dan talked about of initiating, attacking closeouts, and finishing, I feel like he can do all three of those in the right situation. And so that's part of why even though he ends up being more of a finisher for UVA, I value him higher on this list because of what I think he could do if the coaching staff chose to use him differently. And that there are a lot of subjectivity in that. So it's,
well, to the point that it's two sides of the same coin where I actually punish him for it because his role is pretty limited as a result, or at the very least, my opinion is that when he breaks outside of his role, it actually is to the offense's overall detriment. And so there's kind of on off number, or, you know, games played versus didn't played, you know, in what we saw when Patrick McIntosh was in the offense last year, where I feel like I can make valid arguments that, you know, when he's at his best, nobody is better at filling that role. But when he's not filling the role perfectly, it can actually be to the offense's overall detriment.
And I think part of his role on a game-to-game basis is the exact point I was making about short sticks down on Boyden. I think teams have done that to UVA, where they've tried to double pull, put a short stick on Cormier, don't let him touch it. And in those moments, to Patrick's point about like letting him initiate, they've let him go up on the wing and like work with a pick or dodge a short stick. And he's been at least effective in it. He's not, you know, ideal. He's not the perfect person for that role, but he's been capable.
Totally. I agree with that. That is absolutely true.
I think also too, it's an underrated Peyton Cormier is big.
Fact.
Correct. So,
like, you know, it's one of those things of you don't, yeah.
He's a big boy.
He's a big guy.
You're backing down.
So,
and what are you going to do? You're going to slide to him off of Schellenberger from X? Like, no.
Like, he presents some matchup difficulties because of that, more than just a catch-and-shoot guy.
Kevin, do you want to go to another player who is big or a player who is very small?
Let's go very small.
Michael Bame. What are your thoughts on him? I can't believe somebody's higher on Michael Bame in this office than I am.
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible coming from the Ohio native. Michael Bame is, I think, the most valuable Big Ten attackman, and he proved why propelling Michigan to a historic program wise quarterfinal run last year. And to me, he can do everything, right? He's gritty, he can shoot, he can feed, and Terry, you spoke a lot about this during the season. He kind of sets the tone culture wise for the Wolverines. So for all those reasons, I think he's just super important for Michigan. And I actually think I had TJ Malone ranked higher than him, but looking back on it, I think Bame is more valuable, and Malone, it's just so impressive to me every time I watch him, just the way in which he can produce, he is every single way I feel like possible. So, but sticking to Bame, and I'm interested in some Ivy League attackmen if we can get to it. Bame is just super impressive. And how much lower did you have Bame on your list, Harry?
So, I think I had him at 16, and he slided in at number 10, and I think you had him at number 9, either 9 or 10.
Okay.
And so not a huge gap. I don't really have much more of a justification for, I'm sure that among attackmen, they were probably ranked pretty similarly on your list as mine. Again, it was just probably I had a few more short safety middies between O'Neal and Bame than you did.
For sure. No, definitely did.
That was a dig that was supposed to yield a laugh line and it just didn't work at all. Thanks, guys.
It's because I'm thinking about my Coulter Mackesee take too much. And I'm interested in how you guys value Coulter Mackesee. And I think he surpassed Brandow as the second best Ivy League attackman last season. Just his wing dodges and kind of balance play all around as the number one go-to guy at Princeton was super fun to watch. 5.2 points per game, I believe. So, and a little bit of that was Leo Johnson growing up and getting more touches in the Yale offense regarding Brandow. But Mackesee, when I first made the list, I had him fourth. Then I think I settled around sixth or seventh because of Entman in another player. So, interested in the collective's opinion.
I have him at 13. If Kabiri didn't exist, I'd have him at probably 10. But by virtue of that, the points are going to be a bit more spread out this year through that attack line because they are, I mean, really skilled. And I saw it firsthand. To your point about getting to see UVA, I saw Princeton on two different occasions, once against Notre Dame, and then a second time later in the fall with Terry actually on campus for practice. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably not a fair, you know, if he's sitting there like, crap, like my points in the IL ranking is getting dropped because, you know, my teammates are going to be awesome and my line's going to be awesome. Like, that's probably a flawed thought. But from my perspective, like, it makes sense.
Totally, yeah. And I think, Terry, if I was going to suggest if we move up to, because we've been alluding all podcast to Patrick's takes on Andrew Geppert in particular with the North Carolina defense. And I think we should have to get it unleashed.
Yeah, absolutely. Patrick, when it comes to the attitude or the outlier opinions, you were highest on Roy Meyer, Mason Woodward, and Matt Note. So we're going to expect you to speak to those guys. But can you tell us a little bit about why you're so high on Andrew Geppert?
Okay, so just to start this is one with Peyton Cormier. I actually was surprised that I was I had him high, like the highest ranking. I thought I was a middle of the road Peyton Cormier. I didn't think I was an outlier opinion, but with Andrew Geppert, I absolutely knew I was going to have him the highest. I was going to be stunned if I didn't have him the highest. So for the entirety of last season, UNC was either number one or number two in my adjusted efficiency ratings for defense. And all season, because they had sort of a down year and weren't getting any attention, it was one of those mysteries to me of why are they so good? Why are they so good? And it wasn't any way you ran the numbers. It wasn't that they had one great game or two great games. They were consistently neck and neck with Notre Dame for the best defense in the ACC all season. And they had one great short stick defensive midfielder in Connor Maher. But even if you are a defense that doesn't have to slide to one of your short stick defensive midfielders, that's not going to make you a top, like one of the elite defenses in the country. And so at some point at the end of the season, I went and watched a bunch of UNC film.
And sorry to interrupt you, but they also, they had good but not great goalie play. Right, because isn't that the other potential factor in the sense that, you know, your defensive efficiency can be artificially inflated by a goalie that saves 20% of the shots that he shouldn't save?
Correct. And that's – so I would say it's basically when I went and watched the film, that was my assessment, is at every spot in the defense, they are good to very good but not great. Paul Barton, they're close defenders – they can cover, but they're still guys that against elite number ones, you're going to have to be ready to send a slide. Same thing with their short six, the goalie play, like you said. I mean, but also, just when you're one of the top five defenses in the country, you have very good goalie play. There's just no – you can't be a top five defense with a bad goalie. It's just an impossible situation. And so the conclusion is they were one of the most organized, best sliding defenses in the country. And I believe that Andrew Geppert is he's the organizer. He's their Eddie Glazner-esque figure that got them, that made them, there was always a slide ready. It was always organized and their recoveries were always on point. That's why they were so good. And I attribute a lot of that to him.
And for those interested, North Carolina's adjusted defensive efficiency in 2022 without Geppert ranked 27th. Then with Geppert, transfers after undergrad from Brown, number two. So to your point.
Did you look at the Brown numbers?
Brown was, I believe,
13th with him, 44th without him.
Boom.
And so
and a decent amount of the surrounding personnel on Carolina from 22 to 23 was consistent. And then even though Brown graduated a ton all over the field, Connor Terrio was back, as was Matt Gunty. The faceoff guy, which, you know, I mean, obviously faceoff guy doesn't have a direct correlation because we're adjusting for possession rate, but still, like, you play more possessions, it can have a deteriorating effect on your defense overall. And that didn't necessarily happen at Brown, right? Because they went from
the defense being one of the reasons they were the Ivy League was so good to being a below average defense. And so I think that's very consistent with the idea that his ability to lead a defense and get it organized is a difference maker, is a substantial difference maker. And so it's one of my disappointments in terms of media commentary last year was that I didn't hone in more attention on him. I think you could make a strong case that he was deserved to be like a third team All-American last year.
Matt, you already talked about Mason Woodward. What are your thoughts on Roy Meyer and Matt Note?
Okay. So, I mean, with Roy Meyer, it just starts with, he's a statistical monster in terms of the cause turnovers, the ground balls, everything. And so the two things though I love most about him, I think BU runs a two across clear, and he's the guy in the middle of the field, the pole who goes upfield in the center of the field, that prevents you team's inability to double off of him. Like, that they leave him on there because he's good enough to occupy a guy and sub two close defenders off. That he's the kind of the linchpin of their clear. And also, they're a team that has rides over 20% the last two seasons. And they 10-man sometimes. He's a guy in the middle of the field. That's where he gets some of his cause turnovers. And I think his cause turnover numbers didn't decline a little bit this year because I think just teams stayed away from him. And just in general, I don't know how strong this thesis is, but I have thought that the last handful of seasons, one thing I've learned from watching the pros is the guys who have a 3-4 year reputation as being elite defenders from some of these small schools then get drafted in like the fourth round of the pros, and everyone goes, oh, wow. So we thought he wasn't that good because he played at BU. It turns out we were all wrong. He should have been a first team All-American. And I feel like Roy Meyer just fits that archetype so well. And I think same thing with Mason Woodward. Of these are both guys that I feel like are
maybe Woodward a little more because Meyer's been the first team All-American. But yes.
Yes. I mean, but like, that's even more to the point. He's already been a first team All-American. And he, like, at a school like that, when you're a defender, I just feel like that's one of the reputation. That reputation is so hard to amass from that spot that, like, it's hard to be wrong. I put a lot of faith in that evaluation. But just if those guys, if Mason Woodward or Roy Meyer, if they're the 10th pick in the PLL draft and end up like being the best rookie poll of the league, would that surprise? I don't think that would surprise anyone. Right. That kind of influenced the way I thought about these rankings, to have confidence putting them so high. So my Matt Note take is pretty, I guess, similar of they're a top 5 adjusted efficiency defense at UMass. And when you go through and try to figure out why are they so good, well, they don't even have anyone who averages one cause turnover per game. Fun fact. So the faceoff guy, his name escapes me at the moment.
Caleb Hammett,
the Drew King.
Yes, there you go. Led the team in ground balls. Do you know who was second on the team in ground balls?
Matt Note.
Yeah, this is Matt Note. He's the only guy other than the faceoff guy to average 2 ground balls per game. And, like, those are not – with defense, statistics aren't everything. But when you don't – when you're at UMass and you're not playing, you know, an ACC-type schedule or Big Ten schedule, and you don't even have anyone who can get to those numbers, that's – a pretty good indicator about the level of talent we're working with in the defense. And again, like any, you don't become a top 5 adjusted efficiency defense with bad players, that they're good everywhere, but they don't have an exceptional, I don't think they have an exceptional guy in front of him. And I think him being leading the country in save percentage, it is, that's the exceptional part of the defense.
Yeah, I would
think. Kaplan, you got a take?
Sorry, say it again.
I was asking if Dan had a take.
Oh, I am in full support of Patrick's value argument. I think if you took Mason Woodward off of Marquette's defense and you took Roy Meyer off of BU's defense, both of those defenses are drastically different, not just in terms of like their effectiveness, but their identity. They completely have to change. I think right now if we called up the coaching staff at BU and asked them what their identity is, they would say things like, we like to play aggressive, we like to play fast, we like to get out in transition. And like Roy Meyer is why they can do that. So I think I'm all in favor of Patrick's arguments here.
Yeah, and I would just like to echo that too. Like, I think I'm the, if not the biggest, maybe because I had him a few spots below where Patrick ranked them, the second biggest Matt Note stan in the office, most because of all those reasons you mentioned, but also as McNear wrote in our slideshow, he's a big time player too. In big games, he comes up with 18 saves, game winning clutch saves, and he's super, super reliable in between the pipes.
Those clutch save, that clutch save comment is a good one. I don't remember which game it was. I want to say it was Bryant. It was definitely in Amherst, and I'm not sure if it was in 23 or 22, but he was incredible in the last like 2 minutes. And
Hobart,
made,
I think.
Like, okay, made a. Well, no, that is not the game I'm referring to. Man, you're just like finding all the scabs and trying to pick them. But yes, he did make a game winning save against Hobart as well.
I was going to say, too, he threw me off the scent a little bit because the first UMass game I watched this year was against Yale where they just got shelled. But that was because they couldn't clear against Yale's 10-man, and he was almost like when you give up, maybe a half dozen goals off of failed clears and you're still at almost 50%, that's, you know, that says something.
Dan, one other element of this, you were aberrantly high on Duke players, specifically Kenny Brower, Andrew McAdory, and Tyler Carpenter. What do you think went into that?
They're
the national runners up, so it's not necessarily a hot take, but I'm curious if you felt like that was just a coincidence or if it's a reflection of your, you know, kind of overall, you know, thought on the Blue Devils.
It feels like more coincidence, particularly given the point that you just made. They were the sixth adjusted defense last year, so I think having pulls from that team makes sense. To the point we've made about goalie play, I don't think Wilhelm was bad by any means, but they did have a Division III transfer come in, start, and, you know, play awesome for them. But it's not like they had, a proven veteran in the goal that is then anchoring that sixth defensive efficiency team. So I think that kind of justifies those polls getting on the board there. And then I was higher on McAdory for a lot of reasons, but specifically his versatility, like the ability that he gives their offense to come in and hit as either a feeder or a scorer, to come in as a midfielder, an attackman, to come in and dodge off an ISO, to come in and work pick play, like whatever it is. He gives you that option, and for his versatility, I think you have to have him, you know, in the top. I had him at, I think, right on 20. Nope, that's not true. 12.
I second. Completely agree with Dan's McAdory take. I was so impressed by his ability to go play the QB at X for that offense.
But also when you consider, like, him as a right-handed feeder, feeding those big, giant, skilled lefties, like – especially from the midfield, if he can be feeding top down too. Like, his versatility there is just phenomenal. I think it's a huge piece to their offense.
Am I too late? Well, we're talking Duke for a Brendan O'Neill take.
Fire away,
not baby. At all. We kind of breezed through.
Okay.
The unanimous number one selection.
So my Brendan O'Neill take that I haven't heard enough people making, or anyone, I'm gonna credit myself as the originator. I think it's one of the things is it's not surprising when you think about the teams that we know he played on in high school, is he's never been the guy just standing around with five guys watching him do it all. He's played with some really talented players his entire career, and I think it's underrated how much Brendan O'Neill is is maybe the best flow of the offense player of all time. That Brendan O'Neill, when he like picks up the ball off the end line, is one of the best five players in the country. Brendan O'Neill, when he can catch the ball in the flow of the offense, is, I think, maybe the greatest, like closeout Dodger that we've ever seen. That I think of him, not a good nickname for him. I don't think we should try, but I feel like he's like the Kool-Aid man. If you give him a crack, if the wall cracks, Brendan O'Neill is the best player in maybe the world, honestly, at taking that crack and just blowing through it.
I love it. It's a really interesting point, because I'm going to torture a couple of comparisons, or not metaphors, but comparisons. So, you know, we've compared him a lot to Zion Williamson because he went to Duke and he was just behind him and he was a phenomenon coming out. But there are also a fair amount of comparisons to LeBron James in terms of, you know, and I think that's one of the elements of LeBron's game, particularly in the first, you know, before he won his first NBA championship, where a lot of folks wanted to see him impose his will more on, you know, the game and whatever it's an interesting counterfactual to wonder if the world championships were not this past summer, would Brendan O'Neill be number one on this list? Given the way the national championship game unfolded, he still won the Thornton, but I think he, you know, was kind of resoundingly viewed as not having a great game against Notre Dame. And yet, Patrick, I think the argument you just made is sound and supports the idea why he could be the best player in the country, but not have, despite or you know, and it can also explain why he didn't necessarily have the most impactful game in the national championship.
Yeah, no, I think, in my mind, one of the criticisms of Duke, I think, is how I would say they don't, I think, recognize that enough. And I would like to see them more in critical moments, not use him as a decoy off ball, but like, he doesn't have to be the guy with the ball in his stick, like when the whistle blows in an end of game situation. I would love to see them put the ball in someone else's stick and create a situation where if you don't devote, you know, two guys to stopping O'Neal, he's going to catch it and score, but to free up someone else. Because I think there's an incredible what he can do positioned somewhere else where you're forced to take him out of the play, can just open up huge opportunities for his teammates.
I love the LeBron and Zion comparisons. I often fall back on the junior comparisons, John Grant Jr., and that's what I'm hoping for a lot more this last season we get for his collegiate career, is that Michigan goal in the quarterfinals where he backed his man down at 5-5 and threw the behind the back. I'm hoping for more of those highlight reel plays where, within the flow of the offense, where he can just electrify defenses with that kind of stuff.
Go watch his highlights and how many of them are flow of the offense plays. Like if someone else makes his defender take a wrong step away from him, he just makes them pay. I think it's incredible how little attention you have to devote off of Brendan O'Neill for him to make you look silly.
I think the Denver winner was a great example too. The early in the season, gets a slither of space off the Mumbo, comes on the other side, buries it bottom right. And I got to interview him post game, and he's just all about, listen, I just fall back on my fundamentals, fall back on my training. And he's kind of a low key guy in terms of his media interviews, but I think it goes to what you've been saying with how his personality is and being a within the flow of the offense kind of player.
Kevin, you want to take on the number six player on this? Oh, excuse me, number seven player on this list, but number six on my list, Alex Verdaro.
So why I wanted this to be brought up before the podcast ended is my take on it is that Eric Dobson is the top midfielder in the nation. And I wanted someone to argue why Verdaro is better. And I think just within the big games, Eric Dobson had so many hat tricks last season in so many of those big games, even dating back to the 22 when they missed the playoffs too, that I think just his frame, his athleticism, and his shot from the outside, I'm taking Dobson every day of the week.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're going to boil it down to the big games, there is no argument. We haven't seen Alex Verdaro play in games the size and stature of when, you know, the NCAA semifinals are... well, that's actually not true. We have seen him play in the semifinals, but we haven't seen him go for 4-1 in a semifinal win the way that we saw Eric Dobson do in 2023. My point of view on it is kind of multifold. So the first is, you know, I think on balance, right, through the regular season, he had the best year of any midfielder. You know, he was most balanced with 49 points in 15 games. 23 assists. And I think what's interesting to me was it's a reflection of how Princeton's season unfolded, right? Sammy English gets injured against Syracuse and doesn't come back. You know, Jake Stevens didn't necessarily hit, in my opinion, the ceiling that he had hit the year prior. Same was also true for Alex Slusher. And so it felt like Verdaro really picked up and shouldered a lot of that burden, you know, in terms of big games in the biggest games. He had three goals in the finale against this is Verdaro. He had three goals against Cornell. He had 2-2 against Syracuse. He had a goal and four assists in the first game against Yale. He had 2-2 in the Ivy League championship game against Yale. And then he had two goals against Penn State. I guess I look at it and I say, like, I'm not sure how much more he could have necessarily done. I think that what's interesting when you spin it forward is considering what does he look like in the Tucker Dordovic role? And what does that mean for Graham Bundy? How many shots is he taking? What percentage of the possessions are being used by those two guys, you know, alongside some of the other pieces that either they have, right, like with TJ Haley back, or that they don't have by virtue of Minikis and Solomon and Kelly being gone. So I think my point relative to that is there's a lot of open-endedness around what Georgetown's offense is going to look like, and I'm very excited for what it means for Verdaro's ability to contribute. But yeah, I mean, if you're asking who's the best player in the NCAA semifinals or championship, yeah, it's Eric Dobson. If it's kind of on the balance of the season, I think that's where it's Verdaro.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And just to tie it all together, Bundy was our top-ranked midfielder in last year's countdown as well, coming off a 70-point season for Georgetown. And as you mentioned, kind of gave up some touches to Dordovic when he came into town and transferred in. And, yeah, I think it's definitely fair to expect some of the same with Verdaro.
Some, but not all. I mean, you know, Verdaro took 95 shots in 15 games last year. I think did Dordovic took 170, right?
Yeah, I mean at least somewhere in that neighborhood. He probably took like 300,000.
He took 186 shots in 17 games. So yeah, I mean that's half
efficiency.
It's a different story. It's a different story. All right, any other points we want to hit on before we part ways?
Just real quick, my top player who didn't make our top 50.
I got one of those too.
Apt guy to bring up both the statistical comparison to Eric Dobson in terms of goals scored. This guy had two more. And if you're talking about midfielders who score clutch goals, he had in one of the NCAA tournament is Army's Jacob Morin.
Yep. What do you like about his game?
I mean, when you have a midfielder who's a two-goal-a-game guy, that's, you know.
Super valuable.
Yeah, when you're talking mostly settled possessions, You're either talking about a guy who's the one generating the opportunities in the two-way game, as opposed to an attackman who just, you know, stands by the goal and finishes them, or you're talking about settled even strength type goals, and so those are, you know, the most valuable kind because they're the hardest to score.
Dan Kaplan, your player that didn't make the top 50 that you like the most.
So I've already said my list heavily favors like ball carriers and party starters and also versatility. And this is a guy I think that checks both boxes. So that's Dalton Young from Richmond. Started his career in more of like an off-ball role and has evolved into very much so a ball-carrying role. He was the A-10 Offensive Player of the Year. He broke their single-season assist record. He's averaged just under 4 points through almost 50 games in his career. Started almost every game of his career, if not every game of his career. Has been available. He's tough. Starts the party for him. Does a ton, does whatever, you know, really is asked or whatever role he's placed in and does it all effectively. And yeah, so he's a guy that I certainly think is, you know, just on the verge that definitely deserves a shout out here.
I think along those lines, yeah, just along those lines is a guy who I really like as a party starter for Harvard is Sam King and his athleticism coming from behind the net. He can kind of do it all off the dodge. And those jump shots are just so fun to watch. But another guy, Dalton Young's a great call. Both are pretty comparable to Vince D'Alto, who did make the list from BU. And
Dalton Young has an 8% higher shooting percentage than Mr. D'Alto. Another fun fact.
Bonus player would be Mike Robinson. Have to sneak in my Delaware bias into this podcast as Mike Robinson is super good at finishing, was injured a lot last year, and Ty Kurtz took a lot of the load off him as a result, but he's back healthy and he killed it in the Fall Classic with Team Canada. So he's in store for a good season.
I got one more.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I hope I don't take your one now though.
If it's Will Mark, I'm going to be very upset.
All right, go. You got it.
Yeah, I mean, I just think he's awesome. Do you have any reasons? Do you have any supporting evidence? I think, you know, for me, I look at that Syracuse defense last year, and I don't, you know, I use the expression defense by goalie a lot, and I don't think that's what we saw, at least, you know, not in a way that deserves to be pejorative. I think he's just really good, and I think I think his percentage was like 57, 56 in that neighborhood. And I think that like the quality of defense Syracuse played deserved a 55, 54% goalie. And so that 2 to 3 point delta against the competition that they faced with the amount of defense they had to play, I think it's impressive and it's a lot.
All of that would be on my list. And then also 2-time NEC player of the year or defensive player of the year.
I mean, all right. If you're going to give up shots, giving up ones that make your goalie look good are pretty good shots to give up.
Also, Dalton Young has 15 points in 2 games against Matinote.
I mean, congratulations. That's pretty good. Like
exceptional note to end on. You like that?
Hey.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. We'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Make sure to check out the Inside Lacrosse Top 50 Countdown as it continues today, Wednesday, as well as Thursday and Friday. We will wind all the way down to number one. You already know who it is. And like I said, we'll be back next week to do more fall content recap, spring look ahead. Thanks, guys.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.